KPTZ now joins the Board of County Commissioners and Sheriff Knoll at the weekly meeting for this week's public health updates on COVID-19, live from the Jefferson County Courthouse. This is KPTZ, Fort Townsend.
It is 9:45 now, and we want to welcome the listeners from KPTZ. And in a break from our usual weekly update in light of the dark weekend that we had and the protests and the responses, we're gonna pass it over to Sheriff Knoll first to talk about law enforcement approaches in Jefferson County.
Thanks, Greg. I appreciate being able to have the time here to address the Board of Commissioners and also the citizens of Jefferson County. And speaking on behalf of the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office, I want to extend our deepest condolences to the Floyd family. The tragic death of Mr. Floyd in Minneapolis is deeply concerning, and that shared with all law enforcement agencies that I know throughout the country and the state. Actions seen in the video are not consistent with the training core values of the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office. The Jefferson County Sheriff's Office does not condone such behavior. And citizens can rest assured that we're here to protect and serve all members of the community, continually striving to do the right thing and treat all people how we would want to be treated. Every person deserves justice. And we'll continue to work on our policies, improving our policies, our training, our culture, and our transparency. As a profession, we must always continue to improve in all things, and I mean that as a law enforcement profession. As protectors of the community, we must hold ourselves to the highest standards, and I truly believe that and expect that from all of my deputies. With everything going on in our world today, this is not the time to be divided. We all need to come together and trust in each other. So I thank you for allowing me the time to say that. And again, if anyone in the community has any questions, they can always reach me at the sheriff's office, either go to our website, they can email me or call me. But I just want to assure everyone that we are not like the officer that was seen in the video in Minneapolis. And we're here to integrate with the community and take care of each other. So thank you.
Thank you very much for that message, Sheriff Knoll. Chief Server.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. The Fort Townsend Police Department extends its heartfelt condolences to the Floyd family for their tragic loss. The action taken by the Minneapolis officers that led to this tragic death of Mr. Floyd have deeply affected our department and horrified our community. Many in our small town and in towns and cities throughout the nation are suffering these already difficult and uncertain times. This is a time when we who serve must redouble our efforts to build and sustain the public's trust. We want each and every person in Fort Townsend and Jefferson County, regardless of race, sexual orientation, gender, religion, or national origin, to be included and to know that everyone's safety is important. As a public servant, our actions must always reflect this. In the days ahead, please note that we at the Fort Townsend Police Department will be doing everything in our power to make Fort Townsend a community that welcomes diversity, protects the most vulnerable among us, and where all are equal before the law. Our department is committed to being of help and service and accountability to those that live and visit our community.
Great. Thank you very much, Chief Server and Sheriff Knoll. I don't know if anyone has any questions or anything, but I really appreciate the service that, you know, all of your deputies and officers are bringing. They're, you know, I've seen the actions that back up your statements today. So I really appreciate all you guys' work.
Well, thank you.
Go ahead, Kate.
Yeah, thank you both for being here. And I think many of us feel very lucky to live where we live right now. And feel well protected by the folks who serve in uniform with you. I'm wondering if you can speak to the fairly recent state legislation that I believe required law enforcement to get additional training in de-escalation or anti-bias. Is that something that our officers and deputies are participating in? And can you speak to what that entails?
I can. We started that probably 2 or 3 years ago. And what it entails is it starts out with an 8-hour class And then every year now we have 2 hours of CIT refresher training that we all have to take as a state mandate. I forget the exact number of the legislative bill that required this, but you know, and one of the things that I would like to do, there's also a 1 week long class, and I had always, when I ran for sheriff, my goal is to have all the deputies take that 1 week long class, which very expensive. To send people away and to have a hole in our coverage. So that is still a goal of the sheriff's office, is to get everybody trained up in that, and then you would still have the refresher classes. There's also, you know, the implicit bias training, which I would like to send people to as well. So still there, still, if you want to say, and perhaps the events that have happened recently, maybe
there's some feedback on Troy's monitor, on Troy's.
You're muted.
So I don't know if that answers your question, but it's something that is something I would like to do, and I think it's important. And I'm not saying that we have bad people here. But we could, but as I said in my little thing I had written up, you know, we always can do better. And so, as everyone knows, sometimes we have little biases that we don't know we have. And it's just part of who we are. And so that is something that I would like to endeavor more into.
And I would certainly support you in doing that. I went to the demonstration of support that happened at Safeway here in town on Saturday, and was really pleased how many young people were there, and quite a few young people of color. And they said, you know, people so often say in this community, but we're all white, and it just makes them feel even more invisible. And, you know, I think those of us, I think all of us are required in this time to take a hard look at the ways that we still carry racism within us. And I am certainly no exception to that, even being on the brink of marrying a black man. I am racist, and I hope that every single person, including law enforcement, is taking a hard look at how that informs their conscious and unconscious behavior.
Yes, and you touched on the demonstration downtown. I just feel I should say something about that. I'm all for free speech and First Amendment and demonstrating, rallying, but I am concerned about some of the behavior, the destructive and assaultive behavior that is happening in some of the bigger cities. And I would hope that nothing like that would happen here. I don't think that's right. Kate, you said earlier that you felt fortunate to live here. I feel the exact same way. But, you know, I'm sure in some of those cities, no one expected that those things would happen. So, I think it's important for people to have a voice to speak out and express themselves. So,
yeah, especially those of us in power, I think it is incumbent upon us all to be asking ourselves hard questions right now.
Yep.
Yeah, I would agree. I appreciate your focus on developing trust, because when somebody is feeling vulnerable, when they're in somebody else's control, when you're actually arresting somebody, putting handcuffs on, putting hands on, those kind of things, you know, it's a time where trust can actually be started because people are acting professionally. And I experienced this in my nursing career. Every situation's different. The feelings that are aroused in people, whether it be fear or feeling threatened, feeling angry, just the adrenaline pumping when you're in those kind of situations. It's a time where if people experiencing you behaving professionally is where they can feel safe and secure with you, and not just the people involved, but all the people around that see it happen. That see people not using more force than is justified or is necessary. to help somebody stay in control that may not be. And it's a real trust-building moment, and that is something not to lose sight of. And I feel very fortunate to be here. I see that as a struggle for a lot of people, handling those situations. And training, ongoing education, evaluating and debriefing each incident, those are critical for not just law enforcement, but for everybody. So I really appreciate your work on this. Thanks for coming today.
Well, thank you. And I couldn't agree more with, you know, building the trust. And one thing that I think is so important, and it seems kind of cliche, but, you know, to treat other people how you would want to be treated. And I think if we can keep that in mind, you know, picture me, the one that's being arrested, and, you know, how would I want to be treated? And you know, it really goes a long way. And again, you know, we're right here in the community. We're a small community. We have to see the same people again. And you know, I wouldn't have gone in law enforcement except to, you know, to be trustworthy and let, you know, we all in the beginning get in this to help people and whatnot. And it's important to keep that mindset. And I think it does parallel a lot, like with what David was saying about, you know, being a nurse or something. You know, we always, as Troy can attest, we always deal with people. It's very rare we deal with people when something good's going on. And it is important to build that trust right off the bat. So, good points.
Great. Thank you, Sheriff. Golden Rule Policing it's a great idea. Chief Richard, do you want to respond to Kate's questions at all?
I do. We're fortunate that we have a budget that allows us to train, crisis intervention training. I actually completed mine last week. It's a yearly training that we do that's put on by the Academy. And then in addition to that, we do mock scenes, which basically puts an officer in a scenario of people he may or may not know, of some kind of crisis, and it throws situations where the officer has to respond to and de-escalate. So de-escalation is extremely important. It can stop violence or the higher use of force, and that's why it's very important in this department. We do that yearly. And de-escalation is extremely important in law enforcement. The better you are at it, the better results you get from it. Not every situation is perfect, but you can make it even 1% better than it could have been by de-escalating. The amount of force would be reduced potentially.
Great. Well, thank you both very much for your service, for your fellow officers, and you know, it's great to have you, and I think we all feel lucky that we, you know, do have a police force and a sheriff's office that do respect all people and understand that, you know, you're dealing with folks at one of the most traumatic days of their lives whenever you're dealing with them. And you know, I've been a huge supporter of the Navigator Project, the Navigator Program in the city, and I think this, as law enforcement continues to evolve, you guys are great examples of ways that we can serve the community. Thank you.
Well, thanks.
Thank you, sir.
I guess we hang up now.
Yeah, unless there's any last points that you want to make, we'll pass it off to the health officer.
No, I really appreciate you asking us to be here, and I too feel lucky to have all of you as leaders. I think we're all on the same wavelength and waiting for good things to happen. So as we move forward. So thank you.
Thank you, Brad.
Thanks, gentlemen.
Bye.
All right. With that, on to our regularly scheduled program, and we'll pass it over to Dr. Locke. It's been a busy weekend. You're going to make everything clear for us this morning, Dr. Locke?
Well, that's an ambitious goal, but I'll do my best at it. I'll start, as I often have, with the numbers, which, of course, continue to go up and up. Nationally, we're over 1.7 million cases, which is working out to about 23,000 new cases of COVID-19 a day. And we still believe that that's the tip of the iceberg, so that the ratio of diagnosed cases to real cases is probably 10 to 1 or more. We've exceeded 100,000 deaths in the United States, as many people know. We passed that mark late last week. Here in Washington State, the numbers continue to go up, although they're slowing. We're now almost 22,000 diagnosed cases in the state, and the death count is at 1,118, which is 5.2% of the confirmed cases. There's been a slow downward trend, and we now think that the reproduction number, the R-naught, is less than one here in Western Washington. So the cases are resolving faster than new cases are being created. And that's what's necessary for an epidemic ultimately to come under control. Unfortunately, that does not appear to be the case in Eastern Washington, where the R-naught and the reproduction number appears to be greater than one. So the epidemic is increasing, and especially driven by some hot spots like Yakima and migrant farm worker communities and meatpacking plants. So that's an extreme challenge that we're trying to face in the state, is how to get better at controlling outbreaks in that setting. Here in Jefferson County, we've exceeded 1,700 tests that have been returned. About 1.8% of them have been positive, which is much lower than the state rate of about 6%. And as of today, we will be adding a 31st case. So we've now had our first confirmed new transmission since April 9th. And this is also our first pediatric case. We just started investigating it. I don't have many details yet, but this is a child who's completely asymptomatic. And this is kind of the shape of things to come, because we're doing a lot more screening testing, testing before surgery, testing before dental procedures. So this was a case that was picked up yesterday in the drive-through clinic of a child who is being tested prior to surgery. These are cases we very much want to find, because they can lead us to others that potentially could spread throughout the community. So this is one of our big questions now in terms of coronavirus control, is how do we find the asymptomatic cases? We think that this may represent 50%. There are now estimates that asymptomatic and presymptomatic transmission may be as high as 80% of the problem with this, which is just a hugely challenging thing. And I've actually, in this last week, I've gotten a series of questions in my email asking me to respond comment on testing strategies. And a number of them have been stimulated by a very provocative article by Cliff Mass, the atmospheric scientist, who wrote that Washington State doesn't really have a clear testing policy and we're flying blind. And he advocates random testing of the population as a strategy. Random testing, what we call point prevalence surveillance, certainly has a role. It's a kind of a snapshot of where you are in terms of the distribution of the disease in the population. It's not a comprehensive control strategy, however. And I read Mr. Mass's article, and what he probably overemphasizes is random testing as a way of finding new cases. And in fact, it's not good at that at all. I did some quick back of the envelope math just to illustrate it. One of the models for random testing is our neighbor Oregon, who plans over time to do as many as 100,000 tests. And if we did that here in Washington State, if we could somehow do that very rapidly, and if we, you know, if we have 300 cases a day, we could estimate, if we have 300 confirmed cases a day, we could estimate that maybe there are 3,000 people in Washington State getting infected every day. That's probably a very high number. But just for the purposes of argument, if we use that as the rate in Washington State and we did 100,000 tests, we would find 42 cases. And at the current lab prices, we would spend $10 million doing that. So it's just, it's not a good way to find those 42 cases. We have to find better ways, and we're searching for those. We're doing a lot of intensive testing in nursing homes. Testing nursing home staff every 2 weeks, for instance, is a new program. We're doing more testing in healthcare workers and first responders who are working in high-risk environments. And we still believe that the best way to find cases is through epidemiology. You know, the more we can identify populations that are at increased risk, or we can actually find cases and then use those cases to link us to other people that have been exposed, that's really our best and our most cost-effective way to detect this disease in the population. But for those who support random testing, this week a very large project will be announced here in Washington State. It's a joint project of the University of Washington, the Paul Allen Foundation, Department of Health. They're doing a very large study that uses random testing for the virus, antibody testing. At the same time, using a new assay they developed that's very specific, that can pick out the coronavirus and doesn't cross-react with the other type of coronaviruses. And they'll be doing this on an ongoing basis. So basically, in this state, you know, we're in favor of random testing, of population surveillance, but it's not a panacea. It's just one of many epidemiologic tools that we use. So wanted to comment too on today's our first official day of being in full phase two reopening under the Safe Start Washington plan. That's with the exception of camping, of course. And not surprisingly, I'm getting a number of comments about masking. And want to emphasize that this is very much a growing trend across the state. More and more counties are issuing various forms of masking directives, and we're working to get them all synchronized together and synchronized with the governor's proclamation. Just on after I put out the masking directive here in Jefferson County on Thursday, the next day, the governor strengthened his directive for employers and workers, and which I think is a move in the right trend. And all of this is being driven by this growing evidence that it's really person-to-person transmission and close contact that's driving this pandemic. And it doesn't mean it can't be spread through contaminated surfaces or contaminated hands, but we're really seeing a lot of evidence that this respiratory route is the main driver. And so, you know, all these things we used to take for granted, these crowded urban environments and bars and concerts and crowded elevators and all these situations where we were very close together with strangers, those things, those situations seem to be major risk factors for transmission of coronavirus. That the respiratory droplets that we may cough or sneeze out, or these aerosols, these floating sprays that we generate just through speech, are capable of transmitting the virus. And that's why we're really focusing on physical distancing and what we call source control. That is collecting these aerosols and these droplets at their source, which is us, and collecting them with masks of various kinds. This combined with increased testing and rapid investigation and isolation and quarantine, we think are really our best strategies for successfully moving through the different stages of reopening. Whereas we're now in phase two, the criteria for phase three are being developed and parts of them have been released. So it certainly is our goal to move from phase two to phase three in Jefferson County. There has to, under the program, there has to be a minimum of a three-week interval between the phases. And we have to be able to control any increased disease transmission that occurs as a result of this opening. So that's something we're very much focusing on and at this time in the public health and the medical care community. Just to review on types of masks, beginning questions about those, and certainly what we're recommending is the cloth and fabric masks. Every week I see new styles and new materials. They're becoming more comfortable, easier to wear. They're locally produced, they're sustainable, they're reusable. So they have a lot of beneficial features. We're also seeing that the disposable medical masks are now becoming more available. They're fairly easy to make, and the U.S. is ramping up production. You can get them now in hardware stores and online. And although we're not recommending those specifically, they're certainly not prohibited. And if people prefer to wear those are fine. The mask that is really in short supply for medical use is the N95 mask. That's the one that is a real respirator grade mask and is used in the highest risk medical situations. And they're still very much in short supply, and they're much more difficult to manufacture. And so we don't think that shortage is going to resolve anytime soon. And the kind of N95 masks that we especially do not recommend that people wear in public settings, and I have been seeing these around, are what are called vented N95 masks. And these are distinguished by a little plastic exhaust port on the front. And what these are used for is in industrial settings where you're in a high dust or a contaminated particle environment, you have to wear your mask all day, and the vent allows you to breathe out. It keeps the mask cooler, keeps the mask from building up moisture, but it also completely defeats the purpose of source containment because you're venting your exhaled breath right through the vent. And so if people are using those kind of masks, we ask that they tape up the vent and use it like a regular N95 mask, or better yet, don't use those type of exhaust masks in public. Just use if you want to use a disposable mask, use a surgical mask or better still, one of the many cloth masks that are available. One of the arguments I'd also like to address, I think it's kind of inevitable in our very polarized nation that people are raising these liberty interests, that everyone has a right to decide what kind of risks they want to take. Everyone has a right to decide whether they want to wear a mask or not. And I think in this case, people are confusing the issue of personal risk with the public health issue of how this personal risk affects other people's health. And that's really in my view, what a person who's asserting this liberty right to not wear a mask is really saying that they have a right to expose other people to an infection that they may be carrying without knowing it, including people who may be at very high risk for complications for this. So this is really an age-old question in public health. It's balancing liberty, rights, and personal choice against their consequences in terms of public health. And I think in this one, it comes down squarely in favor of public health. This is a small thing to ask people to do to prevent, you know, what can be a very serious and a very dangerous disease. We know that there are people who cannot wear masks, although it's children, for instance, but it's the people who medically cannot wear masks is actually a very small group. It's kind of a misunderstanding that people with asthma or chronic lung disease can't wear masks. In fact, they very often do in medical settings because they're among the groups that are at highest risk of respiratory diseases. But so for people who really do have medical or psychological contraindications, we are developing a mechanism for them to get a certification from a mental health counselor or their personal medical provider as to their medical condition. But we think this is really a pretty rare thing. So I'd summarize in saying, you know, everybody is excited about reopening. It's something as a society we want to do. And we're not going to do it with denial or magical thinking. We're going to do it with sound science, and we're going to do it by coming together as a community. In these last 3 months, we in the public health and the healthcare system have been doing the best we possibly can to get ready for this moment. And now's the time to expand this to a whole community response. I would emphatically say this is not an us against them kind of thing. There is only us when it comes to controlling a threat like COVID-19. And it's not a trivial illness. We are finding all the time that more life-threatening or life-altering complications, we're seeing those in all age groups. So even though fortunately many, many people get mild versions of this, there's no guarantee that will be the case for anyone who gets exposed to it. So now we're being challenged to really make this work, and I'm confident we can do it. We have a great community. I think there's strong support for public health in this community, but it's going to take everyone maintaining physical distancing, making indoor environments as safe as possible for everyone in them. And if you think you've been exposed or you have symptoms, fever, cough, shortness of breath, any of the other COVID-like illness symptoms, it's very important to get tested. We've removed the barriers for testing. We have ample testing equipment. We have a dedicated respiratory clinic. There's drive-by testing. People are still believing that we the limitations in testing that we had 2 or 3 months ago are still in effect, and they're not. We want people with illness to come forward and be tested. It's important for their health. It's important for the health of their families. So I'll leave it at that, and if there's any questions, I'd be glad to try to answer those.
Thank you very much, Doctor. I'll start off with one question that I've had from a couple businesses that is a timely question and see what other questions people have. And that's, Section 2 of your masking directive indicates that businesses need to require customers to wear masks as well. And if that takes place, that's effective when we are in full phase 2, I believe. So does that mean when camping is open, that is when a business needs to require customers to wear masks? Or is it today? I guess I'm uncertain myself.
Yeah, you could probably argue it either way. The intent of it is that when the business is open, is that we would have customers masking. And that's a section in the state that we're experimenting with different language with that. I'll actually be getting some legal advice on that this week, and we're a couple counties, Spokane most notably, has come up with some alternate language for that. What we want to make clear is we are not expecting businesses to be law enforcement officials and to try to force people to do something that they're unwilling to do. What we want businesses to do is to, as much as possible, you know, since they are private businesses, they can set the terms for who comes into their buildings or not, is to make it a requirement, make it an expectation that people not only protect each other, but protect their workers. You know, we have a real concern that unmasked members of the public coming into indoor spaces are the most at-risk person is not the other customers, because they only have brief exposures to that unmasked person. It's the workers who have to go through a full day shift being exposed to one person after another. So that's the real concern. I'm working on that language. We'll clarify it. And there's certainly no rules against modifying it. I appreciate the comments I'm getting from people, because to the extent that we can make it better and more understandable, we'll do that. And the important thing of this, you know, we are not using a criminal justice model to try to do this. We are trying to change community norms, community expectations, and motivate people to think not just of themselves and their own personal health, but also the health of others and the whole community. That's how we'll make this work.
Okay. Go ahead, Kate.
Hi, Dr. Locke. I hope you had a nice birthday.
Thank you.
I'm curious, where are we in terms of getting signage to businesses? It's something I get a lot of questions on this weekend. Is there particular signage that should be used? Is that something the health department is going to provide? Can you speak to that?
Yes. We have some model signage, and I want to kind of finalize that in the next day or two. But yes, we can get we can print it for people if they want, or we can send them the infographics that they if they want to print up versions themselves. But this is a fast moving issue in the state, and we want to get the governors and the various counties, we want to kind of combine all of that as much as possible into the signage, so we don't have to be, we can change the directives pretty easily, but we don't want people to have to be changing signs. So we want it in a final form when we send it out.
And maybe on the website also available for download?
Yeah, absolutely.
As I see, Bill, but one question to follow up on that real quick is, If a store has already made their own signs that meet all the criteria, you don't have to use a public health generated sign. You can make your own.
Absolutely not. Custom sign, in fact, might be a good idea, because you can, any other requirements the business might want to put on it, they're free to do.
Thanks. Sorry, Phil?
There is an outreach program, including signage, through JEFCO Cares, through the chamber that the county is supporting. And so I would suggest that we really work to partner, Dr. Locke, between anything provided by public health, which is already is involved in the JEFCO Cares effort, to make sure there's consistency there.
Great. Absolutely.
Great. Other questions? David, do you have any questions for Dr. Locke this morning?
Yes, regarding children, my understanding is that there's now some research that is showing that the receptors for the coronavirus fully develop in children until they don't have as many at age.
Yeah, we can't hear.
Just want to be clear that this is still happening with children, as we found out in Jefferson County, and do you know any more about the effect on children and the new research about the receptors for the coronavirus not being fully developed until people are 10 or 12?
Yeah, that's very new research, and it is something that's quite plausible as one of the explanations why kids are by no means immune to this, and we do see some serious illness, and including some unusual kind of immunologic illness in children, but that development of what's called the ACE2 receptor, it does develop with age. It's one of the things that makes us more susceptible to hypertension as we get older, and the more of those receptors we have, the more vulnerable we are to the virus, because that's how the virus gets into our system. It has to latch onto the ACE2 receptor, and there's also a factor with that in terms of that the density of those receptors are different in different parts of the body. So it's why if you breathe the virus directly into your lungs, where there's a lot of the ACE2 receptors, that's the most dangerous exposure you can have. Whereas if you have a gastrointestinal exposure to it, you have many fewer ACE receptors in your gut, and it's harder for the virus to get into your system. I think that's intriguing research, and anything that protects children from this is welcome. What we sort of told people at the beginning of this pandemic, and that is that kids were largely spared from this, unfortunately, has not panned out. This Kawasaki-like illness that we're seeing in children can be extremely severe, but fortunately, it's also quite rare.
Any other questions, David? Any more questions? No, Philip?
No, let's hear from Willie.
Well, I have one more kind of site-specific question that I have promised I'd ask, and that's, one of the gyms is opening up to, classes of less than 5 and I think 25 or 30% of the capacity. They have a lot of customers who are over 25, members who are over 25, and they're wondering if they could do gatherings outside, like on a pickleball court or something, in with outdoor gathering, so fitness classes for 5 seniors outside, and I was curious if you thought that would be okay.
Well, it's really the governor's directives and guidance that's controlling in those kind of settings, and I'm not remembering if it's the guidance from the governor's office on gyms really makes a distinction indoors, outdoors. I can say as a general principle, anything done outdoors is safer than doing it indoors. Anything where you've got more air circulation and more sunlight is safer. It reduces the transmission risk. It's probably healthier for you for other reasons too. So I think, yeah, that's definitely a positive thing. Whether it meets the terms of the governor's guidance, though, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I was wondering, both for gathering and recreation, the limits on number of people in the governor's guidance of no more than five.
That's my understanding. It pretty much applies in this case, and it's the rationale behind that is it's a statistical kind of risk calculation. It's just the more people you have, the more opportunities to introduce an asymptomatic case into the mix. And so it's trying to control that risk by controlling the number of people. And it's not to say that we somehow have conclusive data that four people is safe and six people are not safe. It's a gradient. You know, each new person you add a new risk.
Dr. Locke, I wonder if through your and Vicki Kirkpatrick's communications with the State Department of Health, that could be a question for clarification of how the governor's order applies.
Yeah, so I'll look into that. I'm curious about it. And anything we could do to incentivize people to exercise outdoors, you know, that's kind of a good thing. It's a good time of the year to do it too.
Go ahead, Kate.
Similarly, I believe last time we talked about playgrounds and ball courts, there was a lack of clarity from the state as well. Do you know if that has been clarified? And if not, is that something you'd be willing to work with us on and trying to determine now that we know that fomite surfaces aren't a high transmitter? Should we consider opening playgrounds? Provide an outlet for especially young children who've been cooped up for many months, and I personally know the consequence of that, but we're still feeling a lack of clarity there.
Yeah, I did not review them carefully, but I did see there was a batch of some new directives on supervised outdoor tennis and some other kind of sports areas. So they're moving into that area, but. Let me research that, because that's I do know that all of that gets a lot easier and a lot less restrictive as we move into phase three. And so once we demonstrate to ourselves that opening things up, you know, in the very cautious degree that we've done now does not spark a new outbreak, then we'll be ready to take the next step. And, you know, really, you know, we're getting into groups as, up to 50 and kind of unrestricted outdoor activities and a lot more mixing of populations, which many of us hope to, you know, by midsummer, by July or so, that we'll be at that point. And then these kind of very restrictive, very cautious kind of things will be behind us. But we have to make sure that, you know, if what we're doing now is not safe, that's going to be even less safe to go to that extent.
To follow up on that, Dr. Locke, is your understanding that we can't go into phase three until we have been fully open? So is it 3 weeks from today at best case, or is it 3 weeks from after we have camping that we can open?
I think it's actually 3 weeks from when the state certified us as going into phase two. You know, actually, the state, all these additional requirements we put on it, the Board of Health actually put on it, the state was just treated that as a local option. So it was not part of their variance. The state authorized us to go to full phase two at whatever point we wanted to do that locally. So in terms of that phase three clock, I would interpret it actually started ticking a week ago Saturday. So we are already 1 week and then some into that that sequence.
Great. Thank you. David, you might want to turn off your video when you ask your question, but go ahead.
Okay. Garage sales seem like a variation on the retail, just like the fitness outside was a variation on that. Is that correct interpretation?
I haven't seen the specific garage sale guidance. I was looking for it too, because we've gotten questions on it. So I'm interpreting it as that, you know, it's the kind of group size thing, but it's certainly lower risk than indoor retail. So that would be a more restrictive standard, but I think that falls into the category of we need better guidance on these kind of outdoor activities where we have a lower risk by virtue of the outdoor aspect of it. I'll look into that and see if there's not something on garage sales if it's coming, because yeah, it's a really popular thing in the community and this time of year. But it may be that there's just no specific guidance, because it's, you know, it's not a business, it's not a regulated activity. You know, a lot of this stuff is going to be up to people's common sense and what kind of risk they're willing to take. We're urging them to be cautious at this point. This virus is not gone. It's still in the community at very low levels. We'll do our best to suppress it. But as more and more people are moving through the community, as we see more tourism, as people are traveling more around the state, that's going to increase our risk, not decrease our risk. So now is the time to really keep our guard up and not be fearful, but you'll be consistent in doing the things that are necessary to prevent transmission.
Dr. Locke, a couple quick questions from the KPTZ listeners. They asked about when the municipal swimming pool is open, and I'm going to combine a couple of these. I assume that's phase three. And another question is about childcare. And my understanding was childcare can open now with the restrictions already on it in the state. Is that correct?
Correct. Actually, childcare for essential workers was never closed. It had always been open. A number of childcare centers closed because they didn't have enough business, or they weren't able to maintain their workers. But now, essentially, all childcare, including in-home childcare, is open under phase two. Municipal swimming pools, I believe, are phase three. Although even that, as people may be noticing, that the governor's office is being very responsive to petitions and people making a case for moving things that were in phase three into phase two. And, you know, I think that's a healthy project or a healthy way to go about it. These things are not cast in stone. So if the governor wants to change the plan, we're fine with that. Many people don't know the story behind the drive-in opening, as I understand it, is this was a petition of over 80,000 people signed a petition to open the five drive-ins in Washington State. And that's some pretty impressive support. And so they said yes. And so that's why the Wheel Inn is open now. It was as the governor modifying the phase system and deciding on its merits that this was a safe thing to do.
Great. Well, we do want to give Willie time. So last call for questions for Dr. Locke. All right. Thank you, as always, Doctor, and we'll pass it over to Willie Vince, Director of Emergency Management.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner. Before I get started, I will just say that before I jumped in on camera, I heard some discussion about whether or not JPREP was going to be happening. JPREP will indeed be happening this Friday, obviously not physically like it normally does. We'll have the agenda and the go-to meeting information out a little bit later this afternoon. Basically, I'll be kind of talking about the COVID-19 response in a little bit of detail, and then giving folks some opportunity to share some of their stories and their lessons learned specifically from our organized NPREP, our neighborhood preparedness groups. We're also going to talk a little bit about one of our annual events here, the All-County Picnic. Obviously, that happens every year in August, and it's a big and a great celebration of community, celebration of disaster resilience, and it's unlikely we're going to be able to have it in our traditional setting this year. So that oversight committee is meeting Thursday afternoon, and we'll be kind of soliciting some feedback on some ways we can kind of continue to build resilience and continue to build community in a post-COVID-19 world. So yeah, we'll look forward to seeing you all there Friday at 10 virtually. Other than that, update from the EOC. This week we have scaled back some of our regular kind of ongoing response operations this week. We've scaled down our kind of daily coordination, our routine stakeholder briefings from 3 times a week just back to 2, given the pace that things have been happening, at least on the response side. And that is aligned with what the state EOC is doing as well. We've also put a couple of our volunteers on standby just to give them a break since there hasn't been a lot happening in their world. One of the things that we've has very much become obvious within the EOC is the lack of depth and the lack of ability to rotate and cycle through personnel in some pretty key positions. So we've been leaning on volunteers pretty heavily in leadership positions, so we're happy to let them take a step back and catch their breath before the next surge. And we've also had some individuals who have been both working full-time jobs with the county and working nearly full-time in the EOC, so we're giving them a chance to catch their breath as well and focus on their full-time regular duties. That being said, we've still kept all of our key positions and kind of the things that have key ongoing needs active, logistics, finance, our planning section team, obviously some of our core groups within operations. And we really, before we did this, we talked a lot about the ability to be able to stand back up. So although some folks are getting a little bit of a break, we've scaled down more appropriately to meet kind of the pace of the incident. We're going to be ready really at a moment's notice once things start moving quickly again to ramp up EOC operations on the response side. So one of the positions that, you know, we're not scaling back right now is in the logistics section. They're continuing to work to both get information about PPE acquisition out there, specifically to businesses through the chamber, but also support our first responder and other agencies with PPE, which I'm excited to say I think last week was our best week in terms of PPE acquisition yet. We were able to work with the state EOC to actually fill some orders that were submitted several weeks ago that we formally had gotten turned down on. And then after some discussions with them, we're able to get some PPE back in. Specifically, some stuff that some of our partner agencies had become a little bit demoralized with always getting passed over by the state EOC, so they had just kind of stopped asking for it. We were finally able to go back and get some of the stuff. Just for example, I'm about 10,000 gowns to Jefferson Healthcare, about another 5,000 for EMS within the county. We were able to give Jefferson Healthcare a large quantity of N95s, but specifically brands that they weren't fit testing for. So we acquired a large enough quantity of N95s that they weren't able to previously use because they weren't fit testing for them. Now they're going to start fit testing and be able to use the stock that we were able to supply. So we're at a point where we won't have enough PPE within the first response community to last forever, but we're fairly confident it's enough to get us through that that potential second surge. So we're happy with that. Other than that, our logistics section has also been working a lot with dentists, mostly getting them PPE to start opening up operations, et cetera. So we're not just fulfilling PPE orders for our Tier 1 agencies anymore. We've been able to focus on Tiers 2 through 4 as outlined by the Department of Health. So I'm excited about that. Other than that, our finance section has started working with FEMA to submit projects for reimbursement. So, you know, under the Stafford Act, 75% of eligible disaster response costs are eligible for reimbursement to the local jurisdiction. So we actually have our first two projects in to the State Emergency Management Division for FEMA reimbursement. We were actually the first one to use their new application portal. So my kudos to our finance section chief, Laura Guth, whose initial project application is actually going to be used as an example for other jurisdictions. So we're really happy with her work there. So starting to see some
great willing.
It's correct.
Wow.
Yeah. No, she's been dynamite. So I'm proud of that. Happy to start seeing some funding come back in for some of our initial kind of response stuff. So really excited there. That's mostly the big stuff from us. We're obviously going to be helping out in support of the JEFCO Cares program, partnership with the Chamber, Public Health, and a couple of other entities. So we're going to be tapping on the shoulder of some EEM volunteers who may not have been as active in the first part of the response, some of the spontaneous volunteers who raised their hand and stood up and offered help we haven't been able to put to work yet. So I'm looking forward to helping with that. Yeah, Phil?
Yeah, Willie, did you hear Dr. Locke's comments and the dialogue with commissioners about masking and signage? So again, whatever work DEM can do to help coordinate to make sure that JEFCO Cares and Public Health are staying fully coordinated, much appreciated.
Yes, absolutely. And we'll be having a meeting a little bit later today to help coordinate between those entities. So, other than that, those are the big updates from us. Again, we're scaling back a little bit in terms of the response, the fast-paced stuff, to give folks a little bit of a break. We want to start talking about long-term community recovery, and we'll be involved in those discussions. But again, our EOC, our core responders, we're trying to pace ourselves for the long haul. So this will kind of represents a first step in that. So, yeah.
Great, Willie. Thank you very much. Can you give us a quick update about how the movement of the shelter went to the fairgrounds? Is that complete?
Yep, that's complete. Right now, I believe as of Friday, there were 29 individuals in the fairground building and another 15 in campers outside. So, that's complete. Again, a huge building cap's carrying a huge load. They're doing some fantastic work, so I really do want to thank them. We have that congregate facility. That is indeed set up. Obviously, that I talked before about the scalability of the fairgrounds. They have additional buildings if needed. But we're also keeping some rooms at a local hotel on standby if there is indeed a need for those isolation facilities. And again, that was part of the governor's requirement to go into phase two, and that got their thumbs up. So thank you for Dr. Locke's guidance on that, the state's approval for that. We're happy to have that option if needed.
Great. Thank you, Willie. Any other questions for Willie this morning? No? I'll ask you one more. I know that you guys have been working hard at cloth masks and everything, and I guess I just want to follow up on Philip's comment about that to, reiterate where places that people can get masks, and also, I guess, I'm not sure if we've said it out loud, but I don't think the county is in the position of providing enough masks for every business to be able to mask all of their customers. So I'm wondering I might be putting you on the spot a little bit out of your jurisdiction, but can you speak a little bit to that as you're comfortable?
Yeah, so as of right now, our mask program, I think we're nearing or past 5,000 distributed within the county. And you can pick those up. You can find the exact locations on our website, jeffcoeoc.org. But just off the top of my head, I do know that grocery stores like QFC and the Co-op do have those cloth masks still available. I was in QFC, I had to go grocery shopping this weekend and heard on the overhead that Public Health and Emergency Management were providing cloth masks and where to pick them up. So if you need a cloth mask, you can, on your next grocery shopping trip, either pick up or have someone pick you up a cloth mask there. Our mask making group recently got a grant for $5,000 to purchase more supplies to continue to make masks. Those supplies have been ordered. So we should start getting more masks out there relatively soon. And then I did mention, I believe, last week that Governor Inslee announced that it's his goal to provide cloth masks for all 1.8 million Washingtonians that are at 200% or below of the poverty line. Making two cloth masks for each of those 1.8 million Washingtonians. So we haven't heard more about the timeline for that or the distribution mechanism for those, but we're expecting to hear more on that soon, and I hope to share more with that. But really, if we're able to start getting those masks in per the governor's directive, our mask makers are spun up and putting out masks. We will be working with the chamber to see what we can potentially provide to other businesses. Again, at this point in time, the masks that we have been putting out there have been getting snapped up just at the grocery stores, which are best positioned to reach the largest amount of people. I want to be able to give every business cloth masks for anyone who might walk in, but really the grocery stores are those big touch points that have been open this entire time. So we're going to continue to stock them, but again, once we do have a better stock and are better positioned, we'll definitely, again, work with the chamber. Both chambers to try to supply businesses who might have needs. So, like I think I said last week too, I really want to make not having a mask, not able to find or purchase or acquire a mask, that really shouldn't be an excuse at this point in time. So that's still my goal.
Great. Thanks, Bob Willie.
Yeah, Dave.
The mask would be really good for transit too. But my question is about the long-term use of the fairgrounds for the homeless. Is there a discussion about not doing the American Legion this winter?
So, I will address with transit. We are working with Jefferson Transit to be able to supply them cloth masks. That was actually a question that came up last week. So they are working with our logistics section. As far as the homeless shelter goes, that's a conversation that I think is in its very kind of earliest stages. We have a couple of months, and I think we're going to take it month by month to see when and if that transition back might take place. At this point in time, I'm not sure, because obviously the reason they were moved out of the American Legion in the first place was because you really can't maintain proper physical distancing at that facility. So although moving back is, again, ideal, I don't know if that's truly going to be an option if we're in the midst of a second or even third wave of COVID-19 at that time. So, we're very thrilled that we're able to be in the fairgrounds for the time being. And that's a conversation that's going to happen over the next couple of months as fall and winter approaches.
Thank you.
Great. Any last questions for Dr. Locker-Willie? No? All right. Well, as always, gentlemen, thank you very much for all your efforts and for enlightening us today. And
This is KPTZ Port Townsend. We've just heard the weekly public health updates on COVID-19 live from the Jefferson County Board of County Commissioners meeting at the courthouse. Recording of today's reports will be available later today for streaming online at kptz.org. Thank you for listening.